Welcome, Capital Raisers. We have a killer show today with Mike Hardy on to break down opportunity zone funds, raising capital, and I hope you really love what he has to say about work-life balance and his core four areas of daily activities. Not to mention he shared some thoughts on being singular or focused. Are you guys ready to raise? If you'd like to explore partnerships in our BTR Developments Talk Shop on capital raising or explore our new capital mentorship program, use the scheduling link in the show notes. With that, it's Capital Raiser Show episode 268, and it starts now. Rock and roll. I got Mike Hardy on the Capital Raiser Show. Welcome, my friend. How you doing, brother?
Fantastic. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
I love laughing, dude. This show is so fun. I love podcasting. Capital Raiser Show season 3 now brought to you by PitchDex, Richard Wilson's company. My friends over there, love working with them. Want to start off with giving you a little background. I don't do a bio or anything, but you're into opportunity zones. You are a mortgage lender. You got a cash fund for fixing and flipping. You like Iron Manning and going on adventures. So we got a lot of stuff to talk about here. For the audience that has never met Mike Hardy, Mike, tell us how you got involved in real estate and raising money and starting funds and doing all these crazy things.
Sure, absolutely. Well, funny story. I was a pre-med major in college, undergraduate, and realized my junior year that I had zero desire to go to medical school. I didn't want to be a doctor. It was not my thing at all. I didn't sit for MCATs. I finished my degree, picked up a business minor, and ended up going into the world of securities, worked as a financial advisor for about 5-6 years. That was the early years, and you know, got me Series 7, 65, life and health, and just loved it. But long story short, ended up having a buddy of mine that was in the mortgage banking space. And this is in 2002. I just got super intrigued by this sort of obscure business that was not a beaten path out of the university system, where it was all about real estate and people and numbers. All three of those is a sweet spot for me. And ended up making the transition from being a financial advisor into the mortgage space. And that opened up my eyes to the world of real estate and opportunity. I had a lot of clients who were investors. And that was sort of the domino that moved me into the world of real estate and investing and things, but had the financial planning background and understood a lot of tax strategies prior. That's how that unfolded.
I just happen to have a book right here. It's called Story Selling for Financial Advisors.
Okay.
And it kind of talks about these 9 different profiles. So we're talking about the family steward, and we're talking about ultra rich people here, which a lot of financial advisors have access to. The reason that I'm interested in this, because I'm not a financial advisor, is because I want to talk to ultra high net worth people in my capital raising business. There's the independents, the anonymous, the VIPs, the moguls, the accumulators, the gamblers. I'm going to be writing a book and talking about some of this stuff. And people with high net worth have these different profiles and reasons for why they want to invest. Some of them are very, I don't want you to know about what I invest in. And others are just like, I accumulate because accumulation of assets and real estate syndications gives me power. So they're power driven. Other people are just like, oh, I just want the glamour, right? I syndicate because I want to wear fancy clothes and drive nice cars. So there's all these different things. Tell me about this transition of going from financial advisement into now mortgages and creating a fund. When you're talking to these high net worth individuals, did you take anything and garner anything from being a financial advisor that now helps you in these other businesses that you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely. Working as an advisor for a number of years, I think it's kind of funny because I was a young guy when I did it. And to be giving advice on managing significant amounts of wealth without any real life experience is a little bit of a disconnect. So I look back now after having 20 plus years of living life and making decisions and then having failures and overcoming them and thinking from a place of very much a place of wisdom rather than a place of information. I look back at my early years in career as an advisor and I think, wow, I gave great information, but I didn't pass along any wisdom whatsoever. What I noticed, the reason I say this is when I moved into the mortgage space, it was only upside. I felt like I was still an advisor, but I was managing debt more efficiently. It was really a blue ocean strategy for me. And I thought, there's no one in this business. At the time, it was kind of the Wild West, but there was no one in the mortgage business that was giving advice on how to effectively and holistically manage debt for clients across a portfolio of real estate. And there's massive inefficiencies I found with every other person I talked to. That was sort of this aha moment for me, is there's a space where I can use my training and skills as an advisor to think holistically and find efficiencies and then take that freed up capital or that freed up cash flow and redirect it for a client, in my mind as an advisor, that's risk-free return right there. We're exposing things that people don't realize that they're just wasting away. So that was the early start. And from there, just being and having real estate conversations and working with investors and small business owners, the world just unfolded from there. So came to realize that real estate, and I've of course done this personally and read immense amounts on different strategies and things, but there's more wealth built through real estate than any other area. More millionaires made. I mean, small business owners and real estate strategies are where the wealth is built in this country. It was something that's been fascinating to me for many, many years. So that's a little bit of the backstory.
Okay, cool. And then from mortgages, I'm not sure if I picked up on where you realized that there's a lot of opportunities in real estate, if it was in the financial advising days or in the mortgage days, because I have a similar story, right? I have a degree in chemistry and I went out and got it because my father was a doctor and I wanted that stepping stone. I was just like, after getting the degree, I was like, no, I don't want to become a doctor. So I got into mortgages. I used to work at Wells Fargo, you know, doing Spanish loans for all their different products. And then that wasn't helping me become a real estate investor. And I was like, how do I figure this out? So I started going to like gurus and workshops and finding out about multifamily, which is a whole different asset class than single family. I want to know, when was it that you had that aha moment of, I have clients that are in real estate, maybe I should get into real estate?
Sure. It was the entrepreneur side. So moving into the mortgage business. And then my thought process was, I'm a builder by nature. The thought process was, why don't I start a real estate company? And that way I can help, you know, kind of control and direct the flow of mortgage business as well. How hard can it be? It was a very naive thought, but how hard can it be? And so myself and a partner started a real estate company. I've learned this over the years, but there's a big difference between being a business person when the wind is at your back and it's perfect conditions versus when you're going into a storm. So same thing with investing. I started, opened up a real estate company and thought, you know what? I have a lot of escrow business as well. We might as well open up an escrow company. How hard can it be? Opened up an escrow company. It was through the mortgage company, the escrow, and the real estate company, and had, you know, we had a number of agents that were working with us, and some had experience with investing, had an opportunity to buy a triplex for pretty good. Somebody wanted to move quickly and get out of a triplex. Thought, how hard can it be? Let's see if I can figure out how to buy the triplex. So that's how all this started. It was sort of me getting over my skis as a young guy, starting things. And I pretty quickly figured out that I was kind of mediocre at everything because I had way too much happening. It was sort of just reacting all the time. Made the decision to sell the real estate franchise and wind down the escrow company. And I said, you know what? I love the mortgage business. I will be the best in the best in the mortgage space. And I'm going to sort of simplify my life just as the Great Recession was washing in. Instead of, let's call it, a head-on collision, I had already sold the real estate company. I got caught with the lease. I had about a year and a half of things to unwind, as opposed to half a decade of cleanup just as the Great Recession came in. That was my exposure, was the combination of mortgage, real estate, escrow, lots of real estate professionals, working with investors, and that opened my eyes to what's possible in real estate. But that's a little bit of the backstory. I learned some hard lessons.
Fascinating, man. I just got done. Well, actually earlier this year, I read a book that was recommended to me by Zach Haftenstall. It's a Napoleon Hill book that just actually came out in 2018 from the archives called How to Own Your Own Mind. And in there, it's an interview with Andrew Carnegie. The book is kind of like a podcast where Napoleon Hill is asking him all these questions about successful people. And he says that you have to be singular of purpose, singular of definiteness of purpose. All of the mega super rich people that you interviewed, Napoleon Hill, people like Henry Ford and Thomas Edison, they were all singular of thought. They only had one business. For me, it was steel and the railway. The only thing that I focused on was creating steel. And anybody that's got like three or four businesses, or they're distracted and they're not singular of purpose of mind, like you mentioned, the mortgage business, the real estate brokerage and the sales, all these other things. Do you think that any of this rings true, that you have to have just one thing and master it and become really good at it?
I absolutely do. I recently read Robert Kiyosaki, of course, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. He has another one called Cashflow Quadrant. And then I'm almost done reading his book by his CPA called Tax. They talk about the difference between being employed, being self-employed, and then being,
the SBI quadrant.
Yeah, the business owner versus the investor. And so what I've learned over the years is that being self-employed and adding to the self-employed plate, you do a detriment to yourself and those you're trying to serve. But when you move to a business owner, where you've created what I call like freedom of time and place, where you can come and go as you want or need to, the business is running and you have moved into an ownership position or into an investment investor position where it's totally passive, as opposed to leadership with minimal time, let's call it leverage time. At that place, then what I look for is different businesses that can provide nutritional value where they can all work together. Okay. So I say that as a long way of saying, until it's clear that something has lift and runs on its own, I 100% agree. You have to be of singular mind in order to be able to accomplish something important. You brought me back to a story by who's the gentleman that founded Virgin Airlines?
Richard Branson.
Yep. I heard a story about him that's very relevant here. And a company wanted him to speak. And they said, you know, let's just give him a ridiculous speaking fee to come and speak for...
Oh, I've heard this story.
You heard this, right? Exactly. So $100,000. And the secretary says, nope, he's not going to do it. And they said, all right, $300,000. Not going to do it. Fine. $500,000, private jet, will fly you up. You walk out, talk for an hour, get back and fly back. $500,000.
Secretary said no.
She said no. He has three things on his list right now that he's focused on, and public speaking is not one of them. That was a big lesson for me, which is, okay, one of my personal challenges is there's opportunities everywhere. Sometimes I feel like a dog in a park and there's rabbits running all over the place.
And shiny like, object syndrome.
Shiny objects. So for me, nope, blinders on. What are we after? These are our clear targets, and everything else falls by the wayside if it's not going to line up with one of these couple targets that complement each other.
Yeah, the reason I bring this up, because I want to address the audience. If you guys suffer from shiny object syndrome, or if you've heard something like this, you need to have multiple streams of income, and then doing network marketing, you're doing real estate flips, you're learning to raise capital, you're also have a nonprofit charity that you're doing and a t-shirt company. And by the way, you also have a job and a side gig. If you have so many irons in the fire, you're never going to be able to get the fire hot enough to make any of them work. Or if you're chasing too many rabbits, as some say, you won't be able to catch it. You have to focus on one rabbit and master it. And that's why, like, people that are in a team sport, syndication, for example, they stay in their lane. Like for me, the thing is capital raising. I'm just going to focus on capital raising until I master it. That takes me 10,000 hours to study. That's fine. Don't try and get me to do crypto or anything else. And I know that those are great opportunities, but I got to be true to my mentors, like Napoleon Hill, that says, do one thing until you are very good at it. And then maybe you can diversify. So thoughts on that?
I've learned it the hard way. I'm an advocate for it because I've been burned by it personally. I think those are the best lessons. It's still a struggle. I find myself just sort of itching to go after things sometimes and have to course correct, but no, clear vision, clear purpose, clear targets. If there's more than one, then they need to complement each other and lift each other up, not be distractions.
Very cool. All right. So fixing and flipping with the cash fund, you have a fund. I believe you're starting your second fund, which I believe are 506c funds, correct?
So this is...
Let's just talk about the C ones.
Yeah. So I have one fund right now, fund, which is it's Cyrus Opportunity Zone Fund. Okay. And we are an Opportunity Zone Fund. And what that means is this is something that was birthed out of the 2017 Tax Act. I stumbled across it by accident. I'll tell that story in a minute. But the fund is set up specifically to be, it's very tax advantaged, the best I've ever seen in 100 years, just the way that this is set up. And starting in, I think it was 2018, folks that had capital gains on investment, didn't have to be real estate investment, could be sales, securities, anything, but capital gains, if they were moved into a qualified opportunity fund, then two key advantages. One is you defer payment of any capital gains tax until April of 2027. Mm-hmm. That's advantage number one. Advantage number two is the best, which is all of the growth that takes place inside of that fund, as long as it stays in a qualified opportunity fund for a 10-year window, will be able to exit tax-free like a
eliminated. Roth IRA. Complete tax elimination.
Best thing I've ever seen. And it sunsets in 2026. So a window of time to be able to do this. So what it's ideal for is if there's an investor that has a 1031 exchange that is a busted 1031 exchange, and they had a perfect plan, whatever reason, it doesn't work out. I find out about 15% of 1031 exchanges fall apart for one reason or another. This is an ideal plan B for somebody that wants to either move out of active real estate or has a 1031 that's gone south.
So the 1031 rules say that you have to identify a property within 3 months and then complete the purchase within 6 months or something like that. When you say fall apart, are you talking about, hey, that 6 month window has passed, or what are you talking about there?
It could be. If I understand correctly, 45 days to identify three properties and then 180 days to close on one of those three, or a few slight variations from that. But if there's no properties identified in 45 days and you know, I'm going to have to just take these funds back. I've had this happen to me. I move my funds to an accommodator. Like, okay, I got to find a property. I've got 45. This is years ago before the opportunity zone opened up, and I need to find a downleg property, and 45 days come and go and nothing is going to work. And I can't find anything that's going to work. And so it was naive. It was early. It was poor planning way back. This is many years ago this happened, but it was poor planning because I didn't set up the dominoes the right way. Now I just look at the stats, and 15% roughly of 1031 exchanges, for whatever reason, don't work out. Whether it's they miss 180 days or whether they miss the 45 days, doesn't matter. But the point is, once that exchange then has busted, the money, the gains go back to the person. They go from the accommodator back to the person, almost like the accommodators are third person. From third person back to you as an individual, you then have 180 days to move those funds from your possession into a qualified opportunity fund. Which is amazing, right? There's a lot of latitude with this. What I've noticed, and it makes me sick to think of some of the capital gains tax I've paid prior to the opportunity zone strategy being available, because it's the best thing I've ever seen for real estate investors, especially as a fallback for a 1031 exchange.
Now, a lot of people that are limited partners in funds and syndications and whatnot, they tend to be interested in moving their money in and out within about a 5 to 7 year. Once you start talking about 10 years, they're just like, oh, I don't know if I want to commit for that long. So much so, in fact, that sometimes in syndications we've seen, and maybe even have the mindset ourselves of, instead of doing an opportunity zone fund that takes 10 years or that your money's going to be in there for 10 years, it might be easier to raise capital if we just do a 5 year and then not employ these amazing tax strategies and then possibly just buy everybody out and keep it ourselves so that we can have the tax advantages. What's been your experience with people's receptivity to spending or putting their money into a syndication or deal or fund for 10 years at a time and having their money committed in that for so long?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. There's two sides of the fence. There's people that really want to run the show themselves, and others that, you know what, I've got this real estate, it's not working as is, or I wouldn't buy the same property I have today for the price it's at today. I want to sell. I want to take some chips off the table. I don't know if it's 70-30 or 50-50 or where it is, but there's a cross-section of people that they're just going to want to always have the highest level of active control of their funds. And if that's the case, there's lots of good options out there. But for the folks that don't or can't, guess what? This is where it's an ideal solution. And here's the other part. If there is a busted 1031, you're not moving the entire block of that entire asset into the qualified opportunity fund. You're only moving the gain portion. Okay. That's the part that you have the benefit on. So if somebody has a $2 million property, $1 million basis, $1 million gain, and let's just say it's free and clear to simplify the conversation, they can take their $1 million back and do whatever they want with it and take the $1 million gain and put it into a qualified opportunity fund to participate in those tax benefits. So there's a lot of flexibility between separating the basis and the gain. And then to your point, let's just say that there's $1 million gain, but someone says, I kind of want more than $1 million for whatever's down the road, but I see the benefit of this. Let me take 500,000 of my gains and put it in the fund, and I'll pay the tax on the other 500. Because again, it's a taxable event now. Then I'll take 400 or 375 or whatever it is. Then I'll take my 1.375. I'll go do something else with it. And I'll let my 500,000 grow for 10 years and exit tax-free. To your point, I get it, because I'm the type of person that likes to, like, I want to make sure that it's working well, but there's areas of my life that I don't want to do that stuff. I want somebody else that's an expert to handle that portion of it. I find that once somebody understands sort of their preference there, they can make a good decision.
Cool. So you're doing some build to rent stuff. You're doing some fixing and flipping. Tell me about those two business models. Does the fund do both of those, or what does the cash fund do?
Yeah, we do both. So we're building out build-to-rent units in Southern California in the Inland Empire. There's a lot of tailwind of increasing rents. We've got a plan to sort of maximize this wave. I've spent a lot of time studying the demographic trends and, in fact, have about 300 hours of research into the similarities and differences between 07, 08 window and where we are today. That's in process. And then this is in the same fund. With the Opportunity Zone, there's certain things that we have to do to be able to meet the OZ requirements. We have to have 100% improvement over structural value after you back out the land value on a particular project. Buying dirt or buying, you know, sort of early development and moving up, you can do fairly easily. Or some of the fix and flips we do, they're fairly highly distressed and they're people that, you know, like fire damage, for example, or, you know, whatever the case may be, it has to be pretty complicated for it to meet the OZ requirements. But my history in the mortgage banking space and having 15 plus year relationships with a lot of local real estate professionals, we're able to get looks at things very quickly that don't hit the MLS. So-and-so has this property. They need to sell really quick. This is the issue. That's the issue. Do you have a level of interest? Run our model, yes or no? And I actually have more of those. We have a lot of those coming our way now. Those are the two things that we run side by side in the fund. The returns complement each other because fix and flips, we're just really good at being able to quickly dial in and see if it's something that works for the fund and if we're comfortable with the returns.
And the build to rent, like how many units are you building at a time? Or are they townhomes, houses?
Yep, townhomes. So we're in early stages with 40, and the current plan is to have 100 in total with this fund. We may increase it a little bit from there. We'll sort of just take a temperature on the market. But yeah, early stages of that, couple of different projects, 16 units, 8 units, and another 14 or so that are in early stages.
And then the idea is to sell these to individual retail buyers or investors, or what's the exit strategy here? I think you mentioned that there's multiple exit strategies.
There's a couple different directions we can go. So part of it will be a temperature on sort of the rent versus own metrics as we move into the future. Like right now, these are sort of more on the entry level. We'll be opportunistic as we decide to exit, but in a perfect world, we'll hold them for 8 to 10 years, plus or minus, and then start to figure out an exit strategy and sell them off from there individually. But there's a couple different directions. It's way too early in the model to know what the end direction is. But what we do know for sure is that we will highly likely hold the majority of them for as long as we can. Because again, we have to put the money somewhere. One of the things I learned early in my career is we want to maximize returns. As long as those returns are running solid, if you don't have a better place for the cash, you dilute the returns for investors. In fact, talking about this a little bit earlier, but through the Great Recession, had set up a fund specifically for buying properties at auction and walking through the exit process. And we did about 120 through a couple year window. One of the things that we ran into after a couple of years was other players, Blackstone, others started coming into auction and buying properties at 90 cents on the dollar when we were buying 60, 65 cents.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden now, guess what? We're not willing to buy there. Our model is different than theirs. We had a model to exit. And so all of a sudden we had cash sitting on the sideline. And then we've got more cash. And then we've got more cash. So we made the decision as a group, let's wind it down. All the investors had a really good run. Everyone got their returns, sent their money back, but that model didn't work anymore. Now we're more careful to make sure, and my dad taught me this, always be way more concerned about the return of your money than the return on your money, number one. And then number two, if you're managing assets plus cash, make sure that you don't have too much cash sitting on the sidelines so that it dilutes your returns for the investors. Those are some of the lessons of the past that are helping us today and into the future, but we'll be opportunistic based on the winds and direction of the market as we start looking, you know, 5, 7, 8, 9, 10 years from now.
Cool. Pandemic came about 18 months ago. I started working with Andy McMullen at Legacy Acquisitions. We went off to go launch some funds, do some syndications, raise capital for some people and get into this build to rent thing. And at the time, I was very focused on like podcasting, rebranding the Legacy Acquisitions and doing some other things and became very focused on business. And I kind of lost track of really taking care of my health and eating correctly. I wasn't working out. I was all focused on business. I was spending less time focused on providing quality time, which is my wife's love language with her. And So things were kind of getting out of balance. So you mentioned before the show that you like to talk about work-life balance. So far this year, I've been reading like a madman. I've been exercising, doing hot yoga, going to Yoga Nidra, doing some meditations, really trying to get back in balance and focus on every part of my life, not just business anymore. What can you tell us about work-life balance? What has been your experience?
Sure. That's something near and dear to my heart. I just finished the year-long, it's called Live Hard, which is the 75 Hard program, plus there's three different phases that go with it afterwards. It was super helpful. And the reason I say that is because I'm a believer in establishing healthy habits. Once a habit is in place, it's sort of like when I learned to drive a stick shift as a kid, my dad taught me, he said, son, at first, this is a manual and then it becomes automatic. What do you mean it becomes automatic? He's like, you won't even think about it after a while. It'll be automatic.
Subconscious.
Subconscious, right. You're just a subconscious habit. The reason I say that is that I spend a lot of time thinking about how can I create habits that move from manual to automatic that will give me the boundaries and work-life balance that will protect me from me.
Mm.
That work is play for me. It's just fun. It's fulfilling. It's not a chore. It's just exciting. Like there's a new adventure every single day. What I do is I've got this system that I call it. It's called Core Four. And Core Four is four different areas of life that every single day I need to do something each of these different areas. And that allows me to build a foundation that is balanced and allows me to win both personally and professionally. I'll walk you through this. I've been married 25 years and I've got four kids. And my kids are 21, 19, 16, and 14. My little guy, 14. The Core Four is set up. The first one is the category is body. Every single day, I will do something that is exercise every single day, like no matter what. And here's my rule, at least 1% of the day. And you think about, okay, 1%, all right, I could do 1%. How long is that? Well, if you run the numbers on it, it's 15 minutes, like 14 minutes and 27 seconds. 1% of the day is 15 minutes. Every single day, no matter what, I can at least do something for 15 minutes that will weaponize my body, keep me healthy. That way, maybe I'm not doing some super aggressive challenge, but what I'm not doing is I'm not sliding back because I'm at minimum maintaining and slightly growing. Like, let's at least get a first down. That's the body side, is every day a little bit of exercise. Next area is called being. Being is the spiritual and mental side, the internal side. Every single day, I spend a few minutes of prayer time, sitting in silence, and journaling. Just a few minutes, but again, it keeps me centered. And I tell you, I have some of my best business ideas sitting in silence for a couple minutes. For me, it's 10 minutes a day. I read a study that said 9 minutes or more will slowly start to rewire your mind to be able to have greater capacity to think and deal with stress. They call it like meditation is exercise for the mind, the way that working out is exercise for the body. Okay. So that's the being side.
Yes.
Next is balance. Balance is doing something thoughtful for my wife and my kids each day. It can be small. It doesn't have to be a big thing, right? Little note, thoughtful text, just something deposit in a bank account. And ideally it lines up with like their love languages, right? Acts of service or physical touch or quality time, whatever your spouse's love language is. That is, I do something for my wife and kids and then something for myself on self-care. Okay. Because a lot of people will take care of others, but they will neglect themselves.
Yes.
Big issue, right? That's a recipe for redlining over time, you know, or early health issues.
I know that feeling.
And then the final one is business. And business, so body, being, balance, and business. And the business is it's called discover and declare. You learn something new about your craft every day. Like I'll learn something new. It means I'm reading in the area that I need to be growing in. And then I will teach it to someone else in the marketplace. And maybe it's my team. Maybe it's social. Doesn't matter. But I'm going to learn something and I'm going to teach it. So then I'll become a thought leader over time, first down every day. Body, being, balance, business. And it's kind of like four different tires of a car. If any one of them is flat, just doesn't drive as well. But this keeps all areas personally and professionally. Tires are filled, right? They're checked every day and we're moving a good direction.
Cool. We're going to jump into the lightning round. First question I have for you is, what's the best vacation you've ever taken?
Most people wouldn't call it a vacation, but my wife and I, years ago, we took a trip where we rode our bikes from the border of Canada, Washington, Canada border, down to the border of Mexico, all along the coast. So it was 30 days.
30 days. Damn.
30 days, these little campsites. Best trip ever. On the right along the water, there's some adventures. We had some near-death experiences that I won't get into right now, like logging trucks in Oregon and some crazy stuff. But amazing adventure. I saw the coast of California and Oregon and Washington in a way that was just unreal.
How fun. Favorite book of any kind?
Fiction, I would say The Walking Drum by Louis L'Amour. Crazy adventure story. I haven't read it for a while, but just popped into mind. Business book that's a fairly recent read that I like is Who Not How by Dan Sullivan and Benjamin Hardy. I'm on my third time now just because the world opens up when you can think of the who's instead of the how's. That's a recent one that I'm just super, super appreciative of.
That gets a lot of publicity on this show.
Oh, does it? Okay.
Yeah, people are always talking about that book. I got it. And I actually am just about to get Benjamin Hardy's new book, like How to Become Your Future Self or something like that. I'm really excited to get into that too. How long do you want to live?
Oh, at least 100. I plan to have some big goals. I'd like to orbit the Earth one day. I think it'll be economical in about 10 years. And maybe even my youngest and I were talking about a trip to Mars. So that might be about 30 years out. So yeah, I'm gonna say 100.
I love it. How much of your success do you attribute to mindset?
Oh my goodness. The combination of mindset and healthy habits. I like Pareto's law, 80-20. I'm gonna say the daily disciplines, which includes the mindset piece, it's 80%. I think that human beings only use a fraction of their potential in life. And a lot of it is because they don't weaponize their body and their mind. I would say at least 80%.
Do you have any hacks for breaking through limiting beliefs?
Here's what comes to mind. I think three of the most powerful words in the English language is I am responsible. Those three words, I am responsible. Sometimes if I'm feeling kind of like victimish, like I can blame things, I'll say that 10, 20, 30 times in a row. And it slowly starts to rewire me internally to find a solution rather than find a blame. I think those things are tied together. But if you ask me, like, on the concept of changing limiting beliefs, here's the thing. I heard this from Gary Vee. The chances of being born are like 1 in 400 trillion or something along those lines. Okay. And think about this. There's what, 7.9 billion people on this planet. There's about 110 billion that at least recorded history as we know it that have walked the face of the earth. And every soul, every one individual is born unique and has a streak of genius in them. I think that part of our journey on this planet is to figure out what that streak is and apply it in all areas of life. And for the people that have limiting beliefs, so often I think it comes from trying to be like others than trying to like maximize your unique strengths.
Comparing yourself to others is a big problem, I think, in the multifamily industry, where people are trying to be like, oh, that guy's got like 5 times the portfolio as I do, and they started at the same time as me. Everybody's got their own path and their own timeline, and everything happens on God's timing. Be careful with that, guys. Just my thoughts. All right, biggest difference between who you are now and who you were in high school?
Oh my goodness. In high school, I thought I knew everything, and now I realize how little I know.
That's fantastic. Short answer on this question, best way to raise capital from your perspective?
When I think about business, I think about the most important things to me are, in fact, I'll share this. I call them like the 5 C's that we hire and fire to. And that's character, competence, caring, coachable, and courage are the 5 C's. And that's like our litmus test for the people belong as a part of our firm. On the raising capital, when it comes to money and when I'm doing business with anyone, I can really quickly assess a situation based on the first three, which is, are they an individual of character? Are they competent and have value that they bring in their particular area? And do they care about others besides just themselves? And so the reason I bring that up is in order for somebody to raise capital, they first have to answer the question, would you do business with you and why? And I don't know that most people think through that answer. I would first say, answer the question, would you do business with you and why? And are you a person that does the right thing when no one's looking? You've got the character, you bring value, and you would do business with yourself, and you can answer that unequivocally. And then you have enough emotional intelligence to be able to do the 360 and make sure that everybody wins. And if you approach it from that standpoint, people know, because people can feel when someone's genuine or not, whether it's a sales pitch or whether there's authenticity and value. And so that would be my answer.
That's fantastic. All right. What do you love best about fixing and flipping with the cash fund?
The fixing and flipping, it's a model that I know very well, and we're able to generate really good returns. I like systematizing things, and I like bringing in different people that have different areas of expertise. So it's almost like a well-run machine in a sense, and there's a formula for it. I just like that it's a model that I know and that I'm at peace with, and it may seem complicated to people, but it's just a system that works. And I like the transition of being able to take something that's maybe in a really bad state and move it to something that is marketable and exciting for people. That transition is super cool. And I like that in all areas of life. The fix and flip, I actually really like performance coaching, like the people on our team here and loan officers and other investors. Helping people move from where they are to where they want to go is super fulfilling. Anytime I can help move something from unhealthy state to a much better state, I just like that process. And that's sort of a material representation of that same thing.
Wow, in-depth answer on that one. I like that. How about this? What do you love best about having previously been an Ironman and doing outdoor adventures?
The Ironman was a bucket list. What I like best about it is that this is something I got from David Goggins reading his book, but he talks about the 40% rule, where when you think you are just done physically, you are done. You are only at 40% of what is possible physically. Yeah. I had to go through that with the Ironman. I actually wrote an article on it. It's on my website. At some point, it turned from a physical exercise to a mental exercise. Doing the Ironman for me was way more mental than physical. Yeah, I was exhausting physically, but it was way more mental because I had to win up here first, right? The body is a servant of the mind, so I had to win up here first.
Fascinating. It reminds me of a study that I saw on LinkedIn. I think Sanjay Seshadri posted this about they took a rat or a mouse and then left it in water to see how long it would continue to swim before drowning. And after about 15 minutes, it drowned. So they'd actually pull it out and revive it before it actually drowned and then let it see how long it would last the second time. And once it realized that there was somebody there, the mouse that would save them, they actually swam for 60 hours. So first time they drowned at 15 minutes, the second time took 60 hours before they gave up. So it is a battle of your mind and you can do a lot more than what you think you're capable of. Thought that was a fascinating study. How about this question? Do your spiritual philosophies have anything to do with your success in business?
Ooh, that's a good one. I think all of these things tie together. I've heard one time that we are spiritual beings having a physical experience, and that really resonated with me. I don't separate the two. So the short answer is it absolutely does. And how all these things tie together, I don't know that I fully understand that. Every day, grateful to God for the experience to be able to be a 1 in 400 trillion experience of life, and be one of 7.9 billion that has the opportunity to have this adventure called life. It all ties together to me. I don't doubt that for a second. How exactly they work hand in hand, I don't totally know. Pretty fascinating. That's probably the topic for another podcast, but I would say for sure it does.
Yeah, that quote, actually, the spiritual being one, is by Pierre Teilhard de Chardin. A lot of people don't know where that quote came from. Phenomenal guy that was a philosopher and poet, I believe, from France, maybe about 80 or 90 years ago. All right, so next question. Have you ever experienced a miracle or had a near-death experience? I know you mentioned the logging trucks in Oregon. Anything that you want to mention there?
Oh, let's see. I don't think I've had any near-death experiences, some close calls, but you know, I've read some books on near-death experiences where people actually die, so to speak, and then they have a experience afterwards that's extremely vivid, and there's a whole story to it. I read a few books on that, so, but nothing like that. On the miracle side, I'm highly intuitive with certain things. So I get flashes in life and I'll be able to see how things will unfold sometimes. It's really interesting. I have this diverse background because my dad is an MBA, PhD, chemistry, and my mom is just the most intuitive, sort of sensing, emotional intelligence person. So I watched two different models growing up and I learned that both of them very much have their place. It's just sort of been an interesting being able to like watch and see both these. But as far as like miracles that have manifested, I can't say that, but from
your kids are miracles.
Yeah, if you look at just the stats on all kinds of things in life, it's a miracle to be here.
Yes.
But I have the intuitive side that feels like a miracle to me.
Very cool answers on the lightning round, man. I love that part of the show. Thanks for entertaining us on that for a little bit longer than usual. Shout out to the Capital Raiser Nation. Thanks for tuning in. Please leave us a 5-star written review. And shout out to my company, Legacy Acquisitions, and our sponsors, Syndication Pro, PitchDecks.com, and the Family Office Club, my friends at Richard C. Wilson's companies. Check out some of their offers at capitalraisershow.com. And Mike, how does the audience get a hold of you, my friend?
Yep, absolutely. For the Opportunity Zone Fund, it's cyrusozfund.com. And then my personal website is mikehardybio.com. And I've got mortgage group information and the fund there and the Ironman story, if anyone's interested in that. So mikehardybio.com.
Very cool. And that's all one company, is the fund and the mortgage, or is it multiple companies found in one place?
Nope. Great question. Two separate things. I run the Churchill Mortgage California Nevada group. We are one group of about 25 people and we help about 1,000 families a year with purchase or refinance. And we have a loan officer retirement transition plan for those that have been grinding, but they want to figure out how to exit the business. We've created a retirement transition package if those are interested in that. But I do a lot of investing and I work with a lot of investors and real estate professionals that work with investors. The fund I established as much to help my own wealth grow once I understood the advantages of the OZ. And then it slowly become integrated and works very closely side by side because our clients and our partners are aware of how this works. And there's a very different discipline and mindset between making money, keeping money, and then growing money. All very different disciplines and mindset. Churchill Mortgage and then my Cyrus Fund really are side by side.
Very good. Any last words of wisdom for the aspiring capital raiser or syndicator as they scale in their business?
Words of wisdom. Life is a great adventure. And a saying that I really like is one new idea or one new relationship can completely change the trajectory of your life. Life is made up of relationships and people. And my words of wisdom would be align with the healthiest people that you can find that have done things that are further down the road. And that is a way to be able to accelerate your growth path. One new idea or one new relationship can completely change your trajectory.
Mike, what a freaking killer show, dude. This is amazing.
Awesome.
Had a lot of fun, dude.
Been a great conversation.
Yeah, man. We just met today, dude. It's really cool how you can get to know somebody and their philosophies of life in just like a 45-minute or 50-minute session. So this has been a blast, man. Hopefully we'll have you back on the show, dude. Thanks again for coming on, man.
I'd love to. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.